Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Hello, this is Maciej here.
Hi, this is Gene.
And we are back. Today, we are going to talk about a slightly different topic. For the past two episodes, we were covering a fairly complex topic of porting a Linux kernel to a new platform. And we definitely can continue on that note, but we've decided today to break that string of complex podcasts and talk about a slightly lighter topic.
Yeah, so today we're going to dig into setting up networking services on your host for development. We get, believe it or not, a lot of questions on those. And there are some mysterious elements, and there are some things where it's just new ground for people, and we want to spend some time to talk about understanding what you're doing, so you're just not going through the mechanics of setting something up.
Right, because when you work with an embedded platform, you usually have to set up a number of services, network services, to not only boot the Linux kernel, but to get the Linux kernel image across the network to that target platform and to be able to communicate then with the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know we wanted to, there's a big alphabet soup of things that are involved. And I know one of despite my desire, we're not going to talk about the OSI network model, even though I really want to.
Well, that would take another hour, but
yeah, it would bore everyone to death. So instead, we're just going to talk about the services that get set up and how they work. And the other thing too, I know we want to touch it because I know you got ready I went out and ice skated today instead of getting ready for the webinar, podcast. That's what this is. So I know we have a couple different things to touch on, but some of it's hardware configuration that we can recommend and we know that is successful with people, and then some of it's software. Hmm. So is that safe or?
Yes. And well, we'll approach the topic from two angles because we have experience with customers that work in the Linux environment, but also customers that have only a Windows machine available.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks that way. It's just a different environment. It's not as though you should feel bad or you feel like you need a Linux host. You can certainly do your development work just fine. But in terms of hardware, I mean, probably one of the cheapest hardware purchases you can make in order to make your life easy is that second network card that you can dedicate to your board. I found that the people that go out and do that, it makes your software configuration a lot easier. Now, there's a lot more, a lot less variables you need to account for. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you can plug it in your workstation in the back of your car, and then you can get a crossover cable. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days, I remember when I first started doing this way back when, mm-hmm. ancient history, whatever, where some cards wouldn't even work if you had a crossover cable, depending upon the card and how they program the 5PM. For the most part, if you get a card now and you get a crossover cable, you can plug the crossover cable into the network, and it just swaps the send and receive and the clear to send and clear to receive. But you plug those things one into another, and that way you have one connection between the board and the card, and it's not running through a network. There's really no latency issues, and it resolves a whole class of problems.
Right. So this is actually one of the approaches that allows you to set up a separate subnet where you can have a static IP addresses assigned mm-hmm. to both target and your host machine.
Yep.
And at the same time, being able to go out on the outside network and, for example, browse different network sites from your target platform.
Yeah, that's one of the things to remember is that whenever you set things up, and we'll talk about this later, right? But if you set up the proper routing, you can certainly sit at the board, even though it might be on a completely different networking addressing scheme, and still reach services, outside the company if necessary, but at least within your campus network.
So this is good because that means that because of the fact that you have static IP addresses, you don't have to set up some of the network services, which in other cases you probably have to have present on your host machine. Mm-hmm. So the scenario that you describe is one example. Another scenario is you use a hub of some sorts on a network, and you connect your host machine and the target platform to the same hub.
Yep.
And then you have to somehow tell the target platform what its IP address is. So you have to mm-hmm. somehow serve some information that's relevant to tasks that you're going to perform.
Yeah. Yeah, and it all depends on how your setup, right? Because if you're at a fairly small company and you're sitting on some class CNetwork scheme, right? You probably have a wide range of unused addresses, right? But when you get in a bigger company and you have a campus sort of network, you may be on a class B scheme or something like that, and you may not know which addresses are in fact available for use because you have no idea what nodes are out there on your network.
Exactly.
And so I found one way, at least here at Time System, it could be different. One way to really frost the shorts of the guy running the network is to set up a duplicate IP address, right? It's guaranteed to get him or her upset.
Well, I don't want to be at your desk when he comes and looks for you.
Yeah, it upsets Steve all the time because I've done that a few times here. And he'll show up and he'll grumble around and walk around, wielding a weapon, saying,
So hold on. Let's rewind. We have identified so far two scenarios. One where you have a second card plugged into your a PCI slot on the host machine, and you have then statically set up network to your target platform. Mm-hmm. And the second scenario is when you use a hub or a router or any other, corporate subnet where you have to serve the IP address to your target platform. Yeah. So those are the two scenarios.
That's correct. Those are two scenarios, and I guess we'll have scenario 1.5, right? Because it's computers, right? So you can always make it more complex.
You confuse me now. What's the scenario 1.5?
So the 1.5 one is where you have the... Don't scowl at me. So the 1.5 one is where you have the network set. So you have the other... You have your machine dual homed, you have your network connected, but you still dynamically serve the addresses to the board. Just because you've sort of wired things up with its own little private network for that one card doesn't mean you still can't use the services if you wish.
Right. Absolutely.
At that point, it's preference. And it's worth talking about. I know you're still rolling your eyes, but it's still worth talking about because it changes the way you can configure the effort you have to put into configuring the software so that responds correctly.
Right. So what are the services that you have to set up on a host machine in a most complex scenario, meaning you're using a hub to interconnect your target and a host machine to a network? What are the services that are needed?
So the first one is that the board...
Let's list them out first, okay? Well, I know.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No.
So the first one...
You list them out.
No, go ahead. So DHCP, is that the one that you were about to mention?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The TFTP.
Yep.
NFS service. And, those are the services that are setting up different mechanisms, but they are also managed by other services.
Oh, yeah. There's a trick in there, right? And that's where you have your buddy XINetD come in. Now, XINetD works with... I don't know if it's a cousin service or a nephew service, I don't know how it relates, but it has a service called PortMap. And so, and that's something that most people don't really dig around with on their computer. But what PortMap does is it associates a connection on a port on your machine with a certain service. Mm-hmm. Once a service is identified, XINetD will then start the service and with whatever parameters you have sent. And the real trick, I always found this kind of interesting, the real trick is that when XINetD starts up, it changes the standard in and standard out. And I don't know what happens to standard error. I don't know, maybe it goes into a file somewhere of the service it started so as far as the service is concerned, it's still talking over its standard and standard out sockets. And that's how data flows back and forth.
Right.
And then whenever the connection drops, XINetD terminates the service.
Right.
And that's pretty cool because, as another connection comes in on that port, PortMap will start up another instance and it...
establishes another...
Yeah. I know at one point we got, when I was... guys from marketing made us plan out or things. What we talked about, talking about setting up how to work with XINetD if you're an embedded developer. And it's an interesting topic, but not this topic. So
XINetD starts, the first service that XINetD would start that's needed in that scenario that we mentioned is DHCP. And DHCP is...
Does it really do that though? I think does DHCP really run through XINetD?
Oh, you're right. It's got its own... Well, you can set it up so that it runs, can get kicked off by another service, but you're right that...
I think DHCP, it listens on its own port.
It actually sits on its own port and you start it by running either manually starting DHCP on a specific Ethernet port or starting DHCP daemon on all the ports. And then it would serve all the subnets that you've configured for your host machine.
Yeah, and that's really dangerous. That's one of the others talking about, the angry IT guy, right? So if you're running, DHCP is the official protocol is it's a first response protocol. So if you start up an XINET D service on your machine and you're sitting on a campus subnet or whatever else, it'll begin happily serving addresses unless you properly limit it to anyone on your subnet.
Yeah, you said XINET DHCP,
oh,
right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, I screwed it up.
No, that's the same. I'm thinking about DHCP, but sometimes talk about XINET as well. But DHCP is based on a datagram protocol, right?
Yes, it is.
You mentioned that earlier, I guess. Yeah. But once you start up that daemon, it's going to listen. It will start serving incoming feeds or incoming requests for IP addresses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the actual protocol says, right, the DHCP client sends out a broadcast that says, hey, I need an address. I'm summarizing. And then and then some DHCP server responds and says, hey, here's your address.
Yes.
Back to that. It's the first responding DHCP server is, in fact, the winning one in this scenario. So if you set it up for, if you don't limit what network adapter it responds to, or if you aren't particular and say only respond to these certain addresses, and that's in your /etcdhcp.com file, look at the man page, put it that way. If you don't set that up correctly, it'll begin responding to anyone.
But okay, so an embedded world, the DHCP requests are coming from bootloaders.
Yep.
And that's a way you can get the Linux kernel, to get the Linux kernel across the wire via TCP IP onto a target platform, you need first to assign an IP address to a target. And that request starts with a bootloader sending a request for DHCP. And most bootloaders in today's world, they do send those DHCP requests.
That's correct. Right? And that's unless you go, unless you go route number one, which is the simplest route possible. And at which point, if you have a dual home machine and you have one and only one network, one and only one node on your network, you can set the IP address to anything within the address range, and you can set it statically. It's only if you get in the situation where you want to begin using dynamic assignment, maybe because that's the way your board's going to work out in the field and you just want to make sure everything sort of makes sense. That's when you need to be careful for the service. Right.
And something that you were talking about already, when you set up the DHCP service, you've mentioned network address to put that in a DHCP.conf file. Mm-hmm. That network address is really a MAC address of the network controller of your target platform.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, because you have to identify it by MAC address because there is no, IP is, a different layer of that protocol model, right?
Yep.
So all it really knows is that there's a broadcast that came in from the certain MAC adapter, or from the certain adapter identified by this MAC address.
So that MAC address can be found either when a bootloader starts, or very often it's also marked on a board itself. So with that info, if you can get to that info, plug that into a DHCP.conf file, and that way you'll be in peace with your IT guy because your DHCP server is not going to mess up anybody else's platform.
It's a good idea to do that.
Yeah. So we covered DHCP in a dynamic approach, and then we talked about static IP assignment, in which case you don't need DHCP service set up on your host at all.
Yeah, and if you're in that case, for the bootloader, it's not about the bootloader. So the bootloader, you just set the IP address and do a save, and it writes it somewhere in the flash. And then when your kernel starts, you say IP equals, and you just assign it the address, and you put a bunch of colons, and then the word off, which to this day, right, I still don't want to type off because I think I'm turning the adapter off.
Yeah.
But I think it's four colons. Every time I have to look at the documentation and count them and to understand why. But it is five. It's five colons. So you put five colons and then off. And then what off means is it won't auto-configure the adapter for you automatically. Because the kernel, even though if you pass it in all the parameters, it'll still believe that you went to DHCP for that adapter and turn that off so it doesn't happen.
Right. So now that we have an IP address assigned, what's the next task? Next task is to be able to send a Linux kernel to the target platform, right?
Yep.
Which means that you need to have some sort of a protocol in place that will serve requests for a file. Mm-hmm. And most of bootloaders, U-Boot, Red Boot, and other embedded platform bootloaders, they support a protocol called Trivial File Transfer Protocol, right? TFTP.
Yep.
It's a TCP IP or a datagram connection.
So believe it or not, that isn't, I don't know. I believe it's a datagram connection because this is going back because we, at one point, this is a segue, at one point we implemented in Java a TFTP server here. But and so I think we thought, oh, that's really interesting. Let's never do that again, right? So, but when you do that, it is datagrams. And you put it, it has a little serial number on the datagrams because datagram, there's no ordering guarantee.
Right.
And then what happens is that the packets will come through and they'll come with a counter on them.
Yeah.
And the listener, TFTP listener, just expects the next packet to have a, one greater than the current packet. And then has a little bit of a negotiation system if it gets out of sync.
Yeah. And it has to retransmit if there are errors.
Yeah.
So TFTP, to have a TFTP connection, you have to set up a TFTP service on your host machine. Right? Do most of Linux-based hosts come with TFTP?
No, they do not. Like, again, if you just dump, what's the thing all the kids are using these days? Ubuntu, right? So if you just dump Ubuntu out of the box, no, it's not there. You have to do...
Bring in that package and install it manually.
And even when TFTP installs manually, because of the, I'm making close to my finger, security concerns, it's usually even installed in an off state.
So you need disabled.
Yeah, it's disabled. And so you need to enable it. Enable it meaning, you know, go into the file that XNIT maintains for TFTP and turn it on. And then even then, a lot of users are paranoid. And I never understand why. It's like you're on a network that's isolated with seven other people, yet you have huge concerns over your TFTP server. But they'll even change the rates for the directory so that TFTP can only be used for read-only.
So if I'm on a Linux box, how do I know whether I have TFTP installed or not? I would normally go to /etc/xinetd.d/ and look for an entry under that subdirectory for TFTPD. Or there's, I think, another name or... different servers can have different names there.
No, it's TFTP.
For TFTP. FTFTP is another, I think, one.
Yeah, because I know on Red Hat, what I do for that is I just run check config, --list, and it appears in the bottom, and that's...
for the X
config. Yeah, that's the fastest way to find it. You can just grep for TFTP, right?
So when you install the package for TFTP, a configuration file is going to be stored inside it at /etc/xinetd.d subdirectory.
Yeah.
And as you said, there will be a an option in that file that will tell the TFTP daemon to be disabled.
Yeah, and I think
in the initial state.
They're really nice. So it says disables equaled yes, right? I'm working from memory here. So it says disabled equals yes. So if you're like tired or distracted and you look at it and you see like you see the word disabled and then you see yes and then you think in your head, oh, wow, it's turned on, right? And then it doesn't work, and then you go back and think, oh, I'm stupid, right? So, it's in disabled state. And then in the same thing, I think in the arguments for TFTP, you'll see -d in the directory, I believe, which is usually TFTP boot. Now, that's the thing that people that have their shorts in a knot about security will change the rights to so they can only be read from.
Right. And so the /tftp boot directory, the one that's present in that configuration file by default, is the location where we're going to store our Linux kernel image for the transfer to the target platform. So if whenever a bootloader requests a specific image name, that image name has to be present in that /tftp boot subdirectory. Also, under /etc/xinetd.conf file, you'll see enabled services entry. And TFTP should also be listed there as one of the services that's enabled. And again, by installing a package, I think that gets changed automatically.
Yeah, it does the right sort of things for you. I've never had to set it up 100% from scratch. I usually install the package or the RPM.
At this stage, we can transfer the Linux kernel to a target platform, right? All the networking services are up and running for that. And now I can launch the kernel boot up process on the target. So the remaining step is to get the root file system mounted on that platform over the network.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different approaches.
Yeah.
Because you know, what some folks are doing nowadays is they will make a real small initial root file system and they'll tack it onto the kernel. Because in 2.6, the mechanism for a bootstrapping file system is a lot cleaner than it was in 2.4. 2.4 had the notion of an initial RAM disk, and it was sort of bolted on there, and the effort between switching between the bootstrap root file system or the initial root file system and the real root file system was kind of dicey. And I know that's been cleaned up substantially in 2.6 such that the kernel actually always assumes that some root file system exists. If it doesn't, it's a no operator. It runs a few instructions, says, oh, there's nothing here, and then it goes forward. But you could reasonably go the route of including a small root file system that at least brings up the system and gets bash running so you have a prompt. But I know I sort of jumped, but I know that's insufficient for the vast majority of users, because then in order to put out all the services in there to really do something on the board, it becomes just difficult to get configured correctly.
Exactly. Because if you have an application that's very demanding for development purposes, you're not going to be able to have all the glibc symbols in your target platform. But for development purposes, you want to have those present in your root file system so that application development is seamless and you don't have to spend time looking for the right library. So in other words, the root file system that you want to use for development is probably a fairly rich version of it, and hence, because of its size, has to be hosted on another machine.
Yep. And the other thing too is that by using NFS, and I want to just bring that, but by using NFS, it makes it a lot less of a drag to do testing, because if you had something where it was all put inside that initial RAM disk, you'd have to build your application, copy it on the root file system. You could do it in the script, and then rebuild the kernel and then reboot the machine, and it'd just be a drag. So it makes a lot of sense as you're bootstrapping development to use NFS.
So how do you set up the NFS service?
Yeah, so NFS is actually pretty cool to set up, right? So that's another thing where it runs a couple daemons, right? Mm-hmm. Again, the easiest thing to do is to, if you're running Red Hat, do check config --/list and turn it on, right? Mm-hmm. And then the services it runs, the key file is /etc/exports.
Yes.
And that's where you export your root file system.
Right.
And in that file, it's just easy, right? So in that file, you do the directory you want to export, okay? And then some white space, and then the IP addresses that are allowed to connect to that, and an open parenthesis and some options. Mm-hmm. And I know the typical options that the user will have is, you know, read, write, RW, / and then a comma, as you separate to a no root squash. And that no root squash is no under root under squash. And what that means is that when users connect in as root, they're, instead of remapping that zero UID and zero GID to something more harmless on the target system for security purposes, they instead come in actually as root, which is important for the board. I mean, the board needs to start as root and have its root file system work that way.
And we'll talk a bit more about that particular aspect when we talk about setting up those services under Cygwin, under Windows.
Yeah, there's a wrinkle there.
But before we do that, to start the NFS, you have to export those two daemons. I mean services, right? You have to start an NFS lock and then NFS service itself. Mm-hmm. And usually there are services that if you start typing them in on a command line, they'll autocomplete and you'll be able to say service start. If you can't find them, they are under /etc/xinitd.d, I guess. NFS lock and then space start stop.
I think those are under init.d. I think it's etc. Well, could be. I think they are. Yeah. /etc/init.d/NFS and NFSD and NFS lock.
Okay, they're not services started, but by an xinitd, I guess.
Yeah, right? Depending upon, like I said, you know, I'm still old school for that, right? So I just run the scripts, but you're right, there's service start, service stop, and then the name of the service. And whenever I do it manually, you know, the young whippersnapper, you know, look at me and say, oh, what are you doing? That's the wrong way to do it.
Well, but at that time, after starting those two services, your kernel on a target platform should come up. And if your kernel command line specifies the root equals dev NFS, the kernel will attempt to mount network file system subdirectory that was served via DHCP.
Yes, it will. Yeah.
Quote, right? So.
Yeah. And the other trick worth mentioning is that for NFS on Linux hosts, you really only need to export the top level directory. And because you see folks that, you know, they may have put their founders, you know, /op/something/something else/something/something else. And you don't have to bother. You can just export the top level and you've exported everything underneath. But Windows, you mentioned, you can get into some interesting things.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we did some work on it, actually, it's back in the community and everything, but for Windows, you don't really have the notion of no root squash.
Right.
And in fact, you need to remap your
GID.
yeah, your UID and your GID.
Group ID and user ID, right?
Into something appropriate for your platform.
How do you do that? You first have to bring in a command prompt and find out first what are the numeral values group ID and user ID. You can find that by running, for example, an ls command on a current directory. And there will be two columns there, I think, right after the permissions and file size, that those two columns with those numbers.
I think dash n will come up with numeric. Or if you look in slash etc, this is on a sequence system, slash etc slash password, passwd, it'll sort of shadows whatever happened to be inside of the Windows system. So for Windows, it'll say, okay, this particular number here is the symbol that represents the, I think they call it a SID or something for the user on that system.
So how do you start those different services under Cygwin? We've talked about one of the challenges or differences in when you work under Windows host OS, but how do you start the XINED, how do you start the DHCP and all those other services that we talked about earlier?
Okay, so it's actually pretty cool. I think it's cool, who knows. So Windows already has a mechanism that's similar to XINED for starting services, right?
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they call them services, right, in Windows.
Yes.
And Cygwin has a command, I think it's called
Cygrun server.
Yeah, Cygrun server. Thank you very much. That will install a service for you appropriately inside the Windows registry. So in Linux, where things are sane, right? There's a text file, whatever else you use it. In Windows, all that data goes in the registry, right?
Yes.
So when you run Cygrun server and you give it some appropriate parameters, it will go stick in the correct registry entries so that when you go look at the services panel, you can in fact see services. And Cygwin comes with a port map service, which is vitally important, right? So port map service listens on all the ports and then we'll figure out what service to run. And then once you have port map running, then you can run XINET-D and then you can run
DHCP
and other sort of services that Cygwin expects you to be running.
Yeah. Well, one of the challenges or pitfalls...
Not Cygwin expects you to run, but that your board needs to in order to operate.
Yeah, to operate correctly. But one of the challenges that we've observed from our customers here is that when you look at a services panel, sometimes the services panel shows that XINED and all those services are not running.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, they are running. And this is actually a challenge around a Windows host operating systems. And the only way to verify after you launch those services that they are really operating is to look at the processes that are running.
Yes.
And if you see the all those services present there, you can rest assured that they are running indeed.
So, I mean, the Cygrun server, just run the help for that. I know if I talk over it, it'll be just too confusing. Right? It's amazingly easy to both register and unregister service with Cygwin. It was really well done. The guys that worked on that, they should get something, but it's really well done how that works.
Well, seriously. The semantics are very simple. You basically say Cygrun server, then a command which can be either install, remove, or stop, start service. And then after that, the third command is really the service that you want to initiate, right? So XINED-D or DHCP-D. All the configuration files that we've covered for DHCP and TFTP, they reside in the exact same places under Cygwin as they reside under Linux. So etc subdirectory, you will find DHCP.conf, and etc xinid.d, you will find other services.
Yeah, it's wonderfully done. I appreciate that.
So hopefully this particular topic was of an interest to you, and it wasn't as heavy as the previous set of topics that we've tackled. We plan on actually continuing the theme from our last podcast where we talked about porting the Linux kernel to a new platform, and we plan on talking about what it takes to write a new device driver for a platform.
Sure.
But again, just to space them out a bit, we wanted to talk about networking.
Yeah, and again, if you have any comments or questions or anything at all, feel free to write into us. It's a podcast at timesys.com. You can always visit us, www.timesys.com/podcast.
Yeah, I think that's
short. I think it's what I really want it to be. who knows what they decided to make it actually
be. It's routing to the right place. I think that's a good link.
Yeah, who knows? Oh, that's right, too. We can go to linuxlinkradio.com. I think Times has splurged and spent a whole $450 or something to register that domain name after what, like six meetings and who never knows what. But I think we have Linux Sync Radio. So you always stop at linuxsyncradio.com too.
I can see that marketing folks are already showing the chuckling, squeezing kind of sign, meaning guys, cut it out now. So without further ado, thank you very much for your attention.
And we're looking forward to diving back into doing device driver stuff next time.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.